Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
So, David, we have Liz Mullinar coming on to talk about her Heal for Life programme, which I'm so glad we've managed to find a way to make the timings work with her being based in Australia. And if you remember, I was telling you about meeting Liz at a conference last year, and there was something very charismatic about Liz when she spoke. She's a very positive, upbeat person. And because she has a history of quite extensive horrific abuse herself in childhood, I think actually there's something very, very powerful for people hearing her positivity when it's juxtaposed against this kind of like awful, awful childhood. Hi, I'm Naomi Murphy, co-host of Locked Up Living podcast, along with David Jones. And today we're really excited to welcome along Liz Mullinar, founder of Heal for Life programme. Welcome, Liz. Really delighted that you can join us today, despite the huge time difference for our schedules.
My pleasure.
So I went to a conference on attachment and trauma in 2019 where I heard you speak and was really struck by your positivity, and you gave a really inspirational talk. And I think what was really striking about it was the positivity despite working with really kind of like dark subject material. But also when you spoke about really engaging people with lived experience in the programme and offering them an opportunity to really visualise how life doesn't have to be frittered away and destroyed because of early childhood trauma. And I thought, oh, how great it would be for the men to actually hear people with lived experience talking about how people have managed to recreate their lives in a way that they wanted to be. And so we invited you to come and do a workshop in the prison. And I know we couldn't find the time from the operational staff to be able to do the full program, but actually I think you did a 1-day workshop with the staff first and then a 2-day workshop with the prisoners, and that was just so well received. They were really, really positive and buzzing about it afterwards. So when we thought about doing this podcast, really wanted to get you on the program to give some opportunity to think about that program. So really delighted to welcome you here. And could you tell us a bit about the Heal for Life program and how successful it's been?
Well, I'm thinking about being optimistic and up, and I think I'm optimistic and up because I have a solution. And I don't mean I have a solution. I mean that I'm a survivor of satanic ritual abuse and incest and all sorts of chronic things in my childhood. And when that first started being uncovered when I was 50, I kind of looked around everywhere for the solutions from health professional psychologists. And I kind of thought, you're not actually giving me the answer. You're not really helping me that much, because I was like in the film industry. So I was not a health professional. I was just like an ordinary but successful middle-aged woman. And so from that, I started the first organization I started called ASCA, now the Blue Knot Foundation. And I just invited anyone, particularly health professionals who are survivors of child abuse, that we should all get together and work out for ourselves how we could heal. And that's what happened. And then after a few years of running 55 groups all over Australia and people talking about their trauma, I realized that didn't actually heal people, that talking actually wasn't very effective. And in fact, some people were almost becoming more stuck in victimhood and stuck in being, this is what happened to me and this is my identity. And I thought, oh, I don't want my childhood trauma to be my identity. That's really depressing. So in the end, I realized that what I had to do was set up a place of healing, which I did in 1998. And I kind of resolved then that I was going to learn and study and that I was going to establish a place where survivors of childhood trauma could feel safe and where we together could work out what we needed to do in order to heal, that we had the solutions, particularly those I then didn't have any health qualifications, particularly those with health qualifications, and that if we all got together, we'd find the answer. So Heal for Life Foundation is really about by survivors for survivors. It's an organization where we've now had 8,500 people, and we run programs in England and the Philippines. We were going to start in India this year if it wasn't for COVID. And they're extraordinarily successful. I mean, we have, in fact, a 98% success rate. That means people who say it's either life-changing or very positive. And it is really because we're not, we listen, we're just accepting that what we all need to do in order to heal is to feel safe and release the fear that we've never had a chance to do before. So the program has been devised over the years and continually improved, but it works, I think, because we're all survivors. I mean, we get it. We understand, and we're not trying to be clever or intellectual or whatever. We're just trying to hear what each person needs, and we're trying to empower any of our guests to say, you know what you need to do in order to heal. All we're here to do is to help you work out what it is that you need to do. And I think that's probably the difference, is we really listen to our guests, and we call them guests, knowing that just as each one of us knows what we need to do in order to heal, and really honoring that, I think that's why it works so well. And it's why everybody in the organ, I mean, I love what I do, because what do? I see people transformed every day. I can't suffer or get worn out, because I get glorious feedback. That's good.
Yeah, and that really comes across from you. I suppose what's really interesting about that is that real sense of egalitarianism. So much of what's delivered for people who have a history of trauma really ends up recreating some of those power dynamics, don't they, of how vulnerable you are in relation to authority. And I guess that's a real strength of your program, is it sounds like, you know, that becomes something that's not part of the picture.
Absolutely. And I'm thinking today, because there was the team asked me down on the healing week because they had somebody with DID and enormously complex trauma, and they were couldn't work out what to do with her. And in the end, the real problem was that she hadn't yet decided that she wanted to heal, you know, and all I said to her was, come on, look, you know, all your parts can come out. You can be creating mayhem here and running around shouting, but do you want to heal or not? She came back this afternoon and said, yes, I want to heal. And I said, good, then you can start talking to your parts, and you can start telling them you're not going to kill yourself. You're not going to run around throwing stones, etc. You're just going to get on with it. And I think it's just that really direct approach. Mm-hmm. It's not messing around. It's like, if you want to heal, you can heal. If you don't want to, I was going to use a rude expression. I won't use a rude expression. If you don't want to, then, you know, that's okay. But there's nothing, for anyone who doesn't want to heal, fortunately, we don't have to waste our time. We're not the National Health Service. We don't have to. We can just say, look, if you don't want to heal, that's okay. You know, off you go. Bye-bye.
Yeah, and you also touched on something else, which I wondered if you could say a bit more about, because you speak quite openly about people being survivors, but you also spoke about not wanting being a survivor to be you, you know, in that just being identity. And I think, you know, there is so much of people, you know, you see a lot on social media where people really have embraced that role of survivor. But it sounded like you were saying this, it's really important that that's only part of who you are, that's not all encompassing.
That's why I learned very early on that some people just in the end, their identity becomes, oh, I was abused in, you know, this boy's home or this girl's home. And I've been to conferences where they have the peer support, and the person tells all about all the dreadful things that happened to him or her. And at the end, all the audience clap and they say, oh, you're so brave and you're so wonderful to tell us. And I'm sitting there thinking, there is nothing brave in telling your story. It doesn't heal you, and it's not my identity. I mean, yeah, don't swear again, Liz. Really bad things happened in my childhood, and they were awful. But I mean, I don't want to dwell on them. It is my identity because it's made me the person I am, but it's not it's not the all of me, and I don't want to be much more than that, I suppose. Yeah, and that's what we really, really encourage every guest to say. No, you can wallow in being a victim and blaming the world, or you can just say, bad things happen to everybody, and I've just got to heal from it. People have children who die. People have terrible car accidents. I mean, terrible things happen to people. People have terrible illnesses, and it's how they deal with the problems in their lives. That's what shows us as human beings. It's not what happens to us, but how we overcome the problem.
Yeah, it's fine. Really good point. What do guests who are coming to your program, what does having involvement in the program entail?
Well, it involves they decide to come to a strange place in the middle of the country, and whether it's in England or wherever it is, for 5 days, and they don't have their phones, and we really say you've really got to give 5 days to yourself and your own healing. And then we create such a safe environment that we can encourage them to go. I still use the word right brain. But there's a whole new word thing about not using that terminology, but I'm going to go on using it for now. And so we, through visualization, through a creativity, we help them to contact with the parts of themselves they've been trying to ignore. And those parts that we ignore, I mean, Freud said it originally, it's the unconscious that drives us. It's not the conscious. It's not what we know. It's what we don't know. And our program is about saying, for the first 2 days, you are going to uncover what you don't know. And you're going to acknowledge it and release the fear and empower yourself and therefore free yourself from the impacts of that trauma. And that's just the beginning of the program, because then we have a whole thing about discovering joy, which is huge to people, which is about saying healing isn't about fear and anger and pain and it's also about finding out life is great. So we have a party, and we spend all day having a party. And then
imagine that the next quite challenging for some people.
The
men in the unit where I work, when we've tried to talk about happiness, joy, actually that often ends up being the most depressed, the most challenging part of the work.
Oh, for at least a third of the guests, it's the hardest day of the week, and we have to process them. We have to get them to recognize what it is in their childhood that has made them so terrified of fun and joy and happiness and parties. Yeah. A lot of abuse happens in relation to parties. And then we have a whole thing about learning to love yourself, sort of transactional analysis, our own version of, and then it's how we can love ourselves and then learn about attachment style and learn how we can relate to other people in a different way. And I think one of the big problems of trauma is this blaming, this external locus of control, that survivors have this awful way of, well, it's all everybody else's fault but theirs. So it's, we kind of say, forget that. It's a kind of a no-win situation. So I think as I'm talking, I'm thinking it is quite, we are quite straightforward. You know, we don't sort of mess around. It's like, this is how it is. But you can change. And people profoundly, beautifully, wonderfully change. And I got a lovely letter today from somebody, from a wife, whose husband was there here last week. And she said, I knew our whole world had changed when my husband came home. And the first thing he said to me, it kind of makes me really emotional. She said, I've realized I have to learn to love myself before I can give to you and my children. And she said her heart stopped because she thought, oh my God, he's found out the truth of how he needs to heal. And it's that sort of stuff.
That's really moving.
Yeah, getting back to your beginning thing, that's why I'm utterly, utterly positive. All I want to know, everyone to know, is that they can heal, that they can change.
A lot is achieved in 5 days. You know, when you think about people who end up, you know, having lots and lots of therapeutic interventions that don't really get them anywhere.
Mm. What we do is give them lots of tools and then send them back to their therapist or whoever. It's the beginning, or it's the continuation, or it's the ending of a journey, but we just get into the core trauma. You know, then they can go back and do their CBT and their DBT and their working out and different new issues that come up. But what we do is give them hope. people leave us and they say, you changed my life because I realized I could change.
Yeah,
I think that's what we give people, that they can change and that it's within themselves. It's not up to anybody else. The only person who can change anybody is themselves.
And I think it's that kind of like sense that you're giving people hope that was what people were really responding to at the conference when you spoke, and what made me want to try and capture all of that for the men. So yeah, that really comes across from you as well as from the program.
I think one of the really negative things in the whole therapeutic relationship is transference. I think I'm off on a tangent. Is that okay? it's this thing of my client needs me and I've got to be there for my client. And I do everything to train all of our people here to say, you don't want the person to love you at the end of the week. You want the person to love themselves. All you got to do all week is be saying to them, you're doing it. I'm not doing it. You're doing it. And I think Freud started that with that whole psychoanalytical approach and the whole therapeutic relationship. And I'm more and more thinking that puts a huge weight on the therapist and it makes the person reliant on the therapist, which means once again, they're reliant upon somebody else and they continue their sense of disempowerment from their childhood. So I think that's really, I'm feeling more and more how important it is to empower clients and not in any way to feel I've got to let them, you know, I've got to let them lean on me, apart from certain really critical moments with people who've never been nurtured. So there are a few exceptions to that rule. People have to learn how to nurture themselves. But I think that's probably something I feel strongly about.
Yeah, it's kind of sounding like a coaching mindset, you know, that where actually you might guide somebody, offer somebody sense of what their options are, but ultimately they're taking responsibility for their change, their growth and their development. It sounds like that difference.
I think that's really important. Yes, it's just like the woman today. It was like she was creating mayhem and it's all because she hadn't decided that she wanted to heal, and the moment she did it was all different. Because at the moment she did, she took control of her parts. She took control of everything, and all the violence and stuff stopped immediately because she decided she didn't want to be like that. She didn't need to be like that to get attention too.
Thinking that you're doing trauma-focused work can be really painful. I mean, you've alluded to that several times. And yet you seem to balance that against the need to keep people nourished and well resourced, and people want to come back to you and to be volunteers. How do you manage all that?
I think because the people come back because they are so excited, stunned, feel so enriched by what they discover in a week. So they go, I want to give back. So we have a mixture of people. We have people who want to give back, and then they may spend a year with us and then they really learn about trauma, and then they're not health professionals and they go off then and train and become counsellors or therapists or psychologists. And then we have the sort of psychologists, like we've got two living on the property at the moment, who have themselves been trying to help everybody else and suddenly realise that actually it's time to help themselves, I think. It is remarkable that our organisation is 90% run by volunteers. Yes, it is remarkable. And most of them are fully qualified professionals. And they do it because they're passionate about it. We don't have enough money to pay them. So it's, and I think that's part of what the guests love, because they know we're all doing it. I'm a volunteer, you know. We're all doing it because we want to help others. And I think that altruistic feeling is incredibly important to people who've been in psychiatric hospitals and the mental health system and they've had therapist after therapist and they've felt a burden on society, and you know, it to hit, meet a group of people who say, no, we're just here because we really just want you to discover life. And that's, I think, very powerful. It's one of the things I wouldn't like us in the end. I mean, it would be wonderful to pay everybody on one hand, but on the other, we would lose something.
Sure. So do you talk among yourselves? Do you have staff meetings or Because it sounds in a way as if you don't have staff, you know, so.
Oh, well, so on each week we have a team of a minimum of 5, and on kids camps we have a minimum of 12, and we meet twice a day. We don't meet twice a day to discuss the clients and case notes. We meet twice a day to say how we are feeling, to say, you know, how we think we are traveling, as well as what else we might be doing to help our guests. So our staff meetings are mostly about as much about ourselves as they are about the people we're working with. On the property, we have eight people living, and yes, we meet and have community days like they've been having today. I got caught up, but where we recognize it's important to sort of be together and share together and do things together. So I'm not sure if I've answered your question, David. I think it's all about it. Life is, even in work, life is much more than work and worrying. I'm always saying to everyone, we've all got to fill up our love bucket so we can give out to others. And unless we're feeling full, I can't give out to other people if I'm not feeling full of love and looking after myself. Like tonight, I completely switched off. I was watching The Crown because I'd had a really heavy day, and every intention, I had alarm clocks to remember, but I just went, okay, this is me time now.
So who's the boss? How is authority managed?
I say that, for instance, that I have responsibility but not power. Mm-hmm. So I am a great believer that trauma is created by power over people, and we want to try and create an environment which is responsibility but not power. Because the moment we impose, we have consensus, we don't vote about anything. And I say to people, this is what I think should happen. But if someone disagrees with me, please God, I never say, well, I'm sorry, it's that way because that's how it's going to be. I say, okay, let's listen. And then I have to have the humility to say, oh, I said, wow, that's a much better idea than mine. Oh yeah, let's do that. So I think what I'm trying to do is actually quite challenging. But I think it's really important if you're working with trauma survivors. I do a lot of training of organizations and trying to get everyone to understand we really have to empower the people we are with, and we have to not be loving the power. And I think a lot of people in the social welfare system love the power. They love the rescuing. They love looking after people. They love the fact that they're exhausted at night because they've given so much to the needy people in their care. And that's all wrong.
No, it's great the way you put that, because, I mean, I agree with you. I think power and authority and the misuse of authority is so often right at the heart of abuse.
Mm. Well, it's the heart of abuse, and unfortunately I think our social welfare system across the board generally is all about let's rescue the people, let's help the poor people, they can't help themselves, rather than these are people who need me to walk alongside them for the moment, but they're absolutely able to sort themselves out once they're given the right support.
And I think you kind of like, when you were talking about being paid or not paid, obviously when an organisation has money, it allows it to do things. But actually, there is that dynamic, isn't there, of when therapists care for the patient or the client, that it's very easy to say, well, that's because you're being paid to look after
me. That's right, exactly. You're being paid to care for me.
Mm. Yes, but I also, I mean, within our service, we work really hard to say that the therapist needs to be at least working to like that. You don't automatically necessarily like everyone as soon as you meet them, but you have to have the integrity of spirit to want to like the person. But I've heard so many professionals say, well, I don't have to like this person to work with them. It kind of like giving themselves permission to not care, and yet they're taking money for a caring role. So, you know, I think it raises all sorts of interesting issues, really.
I actually say we have to really love our guests. I say we don't have to like them, but we have to love them.
Well, that you see that's another interesting thing. If you use the word love within the context of forensic work, it makes people very, very. I mean, we do talk openly about that, and I get around that, I guess, by referring to agape, because I think that makes
good way. Yes,
think about it, because I think as soon as you start using the word love in forensic, people start projecting their own stuff about what that means, rather than kind of like love for your fellow human beings, wanting to see people grow and flourish.
I think we can love, you see, without liking, and I think agape is that in spiritual love. It's if I approach someone, even if I'm not liking them, but I try to look at, I mean, for me, the Christ in them, but, or, you know, whatever, I just try to be just always loving, then I don't suddenly. Had such an angry person on the phone the other day because I'd marked an assignment of hers and she absolutely, you know, she was right off the planet at me. And I started by reacting and saying, now listen to me, etc. And I caught myself, and so I just had to stop and I let her talk on for about 10 minutes. She was going on and on. And I just sat there sort of breathing, thinking, love her, Liz, love her. You've just got to love her and listen. And it was really interesting because I started loving her and suddenly she completely changed. And she suddenly said, oh, thanks, Liz, very much. You really listened to me. I really, really appreciate this talk. Goodbye. And it was like, oh, and it was a really good lesson to me to not, I mean, they say the vagus system is impacted by justification. And it is so true. If we can all stop justifying, the world would be a much easier place.
So what is this thing called love? I think that's probably a song title, but what do you mean by that?
I think it's looking at someone with warmth and not letting any negative feelings, any judgment come in. I think it's being there without judgment, actually. I think it's judgment. It's when I look at someone and think, oh, you're so boring, or you're such a pain in the neck, or you're so angry, or you're on drugs. I think it's probably just being there and just thinking you're another human being like me. I think maybe.
Yeah, perhaps also.
I mean, for me, I'm always saying, God is love and love is God. And all I'm trying to do in my life is to fill my life more with love and less with fear. And that is the healing journey for survivors of childhood trauma. It's getting rid of the fear that has been dominating our lives and replacing it with love. Love of self, love of others, but love of self first.
I wonder if part of that is having the compassion to recognize that people are generally doing their best. You know, it might not be the most helpful way to be, but actually generally people are doing their best to get by. And I think when we recognize that, it makes it easier to stay in a more compassionate place with the person.
I think that's very, very true, Naomi. That's the same thing of being non-judgmental. And I'm always saying that our most challenging guests are the ones who are in most need and the most pain and suffer the worst trauma. When you say, how do you judge trauma? I say you judge trauma by the behavior of the person, and the heart, the more they're impossible, the more they've suffered. So the more love we have to give them. So I do use the word love, David. It is a sort of feeling of we just have to... Yeah, be there and not go, oh God, you give me an ugh. We're not allowed to say that here.
But it is a slightly problematic word, isn't it? Because the meaning of the word resides in the mind of the person who's speaking it and the person who's hearing it.
I've had so many people who've said to me, what is love? I've also had so many people who said, I didn't know what love is, and I've learnt it, you know, I've realised what it is. And I think it's a huge issue, what is love.
I think one of the things that's really striking in the justice system as well is it's kind of acceptable to hate the patient, the person that you're working with. It's okay to have an attitude of, well, fuck you then. And sometimes people might actually say that and with little limited consequences, but actually to talk about love becomes this really big scary thing. And we once had somebody who wrote a poem to his therapist, and he compared her to a flower, And it was, and you know, it's really beautiful. And it was about that recognition that she was giving him something really beautiful in caring for him, where he'd not felt cared for before. And that really frightened the system. You know, they wanted to remove him to segregation because he didn't go there, but because that was because we'd been advocating for him, that this is just an appreciation of somebody who's actually been kind to me for the first time in my life.
But I can recognize it as kindness.
Yes.
Sorry, David, I interrupted you.
Absolutely. So one of the striking elements we've spoken about is that emphasis on hope. And yet you work with many people who've been written off by the system as being beyond hope. So people with addictions, prisoners and so on. How do you manage to keep hopeful where other people have often given up?
Well, because anyone who comes here, we tell them they can heal and we help give them hope. So therefore, I don't ever have to not feel hopeful at all. I think we're very blessed because, unlike, say, in the prison system, if someone comes along, and we've had, the courts used to send people on their parole, you know, you'll get a shorter parole if you go and do a week at Heal for Life. And it was ghastly because people would come in order to get their parole. So we're very blessed in that we can say, includes children, any child only comes here if they want to heal. And every child is asked, do you want to heal? No. If you don't want to heal, don't come. So I suppose we're very blessed in that way. We don't have people who don't want to heal. We have people who've made that decision. And it sometimes takes them 2, 3, 4 years before they decide to heal. But when they decide to, then we say, we're here for you. And whereas in the prison system, and I know in your wonderful unit, they're selected, but there's still a whole lot of problems you have that we don't have. Well, I mean, people in private business, therapists, that they can absolutely always do that. They never have to have a client without hope. But, if you're working in the National Health Service and you have to see, so you're mandated to see certain people, you have to see them.
Yeah, we actually only take people who have nowhere else to go. If there's something else they could do, we wouldn't take them because we're a costly resource. So we only take people when they've been written off as being beyond hope. So I really, connect with that sense. But yes, I guess at least you can have that conversation about where are you at and are you at a point where this is the right thing for you?
But I do remember when talking to your people that I was talking about, it's not your fault, what happened to you as a child, et cetera, et cetera. And I deeply remember one guy and he said, but it is my fault. And I said, why is it your fault? And he said, because it was a sweet lolly and my parents told me never to, never to take sweets. I hope it's all right to be telling this story. And I said, but it isn't your fault. How old were you? It wasn't your fault. And the other inmates were saying, it wasn't your fault, mate. But I could see in his face, he actually couldn't cope with the concept of it not being his fault. He actually couldn't cope. And he didn't come back. And he's the only person who didn't come back. And I realized for him, he wasn't able for it not to be his fault. If something in his system, he would need a lot more work. So, yeah. Why am I saying that to say, it's hard. It's hard. Some people, we have to work really hard to get them to believe there's a hope, to find a way through to make them believe in themselves. And there are some people who that's no longer possible.
No, there's something really heartbreaking about how people who've already been really badly let down by the system are often blamed for their difficulties later on in life, in terms of, so they have difficulties trusting or cooperating with authority. That can be used to eject the person from that service, and send them somewhere else. But it sounds like as a voluntary organisation, that's not a difficulty that you face so much because you have this upfront conversation about, are you ready to heal?
Absolutely. In fact, we were discussing today because of this woman who came and had been creating mayhem for the last 3 days because she didn't want to heal. And that's why I said the mistake I said to the facilitator was you're not really asking them on the phone, do you want to heal? Because if then she wouldn't have come. Now, is that good? Is that bad? Well, she'd have had to have made the decision. As it is, she's now made the decision to heal, but she created a bit of mayhem en route to deciding, because it's like they always say, you can take a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. I mean, if someone doesn't want to heal, that's, I think, when people get exhausted. I think that's when health professionals get exhausted, thinking it's their responsibility to try and get that, think of another way to try and get that client to change, rather than saying, well, it's your choice, you are the options. And I think it's that rescuing attitude and sense of responsibility that therapists have that makes their lives often very hard.
Yes, yeah, so the voluntary element as well, coupled with the not being an authority over the person, you know, that you're there as.
I mean, all our facilitators are paid. The people, the team leader on every week is paid. And obviously our psychologists and people in our trauma centre are paid, but the rest of the team are not paid.
So I was thinking of somewhere else where I used to work, Liz. It was the first prison I worked in. I had a governor there who was an old-fashioned governor, if you like, pre-managerialism governor, a chap called Tim Newell. Mm. And shortly after I started work there, he invited me up to talk to him, and he talked to me for 2 hours, which I was pretty impressed with, I have to say. But wow. One of the things that he said that really struck for me was that the guys in the prison, one thing they had plenty of was time, and the thing they had less of was hope. So they had lots of time, not so much hope. So it always seemed to me that one of our tasks really was to create a setting where guys could develop some hope, and of course along with that some element of trust. So I guess every setting is different, every group of people is different with different needs.
Probably it's hope in everywhere, isn't it? People need to be given, whether you're the homeless or whatever you're dealing with, it's giving people hope that they can change, don't you think?
Yeah.
That sense of hopelessness is because people think they're stuck, that they can't change. Mm-hmm. And everybody can change. And that's, I mean, the brain being plastic is just such a huge, huge, huge change, but it's not been really embraced yet totally, that people can actually change.
No, I agree. It's coming in. I mean, I think the change and understanding of that concept has developed amazingly over the past 10 to 15 years. So we've moved, I think. I don't know what you think, Naomi, but we've moved from having treatment settings which were extremely didactic and rigid to being much more flexible and, as we say, trauma focused, really interested in the person. So
I think that's worldwide.
Yes, it is, fortunately. Yes. At the moment, there's a big drive in the UK, or there was before COVID came in, for prisons and secure hospitals to become trauma focused. And I know from talking to colleagues that it can be difficult to gain traction for this agenda in some of these places. What are your thoughts on how we can achieve that kind of trauma informed, trauma focused? And we use those two terms, focused and trauma informed, slightly interchangeably, not always knowing what they mean.
For me, what people forget is that if you're going to be trauma informed, trauma focused, it means not having power over people. It means letting people take responsibility for themselves. But it also means, which I find sometimes very challenging, setting very clear guidelines for behavior with people. So I was doing, and one of the things I absolutely insist on is if I'm training an organization, the CEO and the manager and everybody has to be there. And a very well-known charity's homeless center in Sydney asked me to go along and train them all. And it was a 2-day training. And, you know, there was 100 staff there. And then they were all, then the CEO and the manager and everyone was there. And we talked and we talked. And I said, well, trauma-informed practice means creating a safe environment. So in terms of the homeless, it means you'd have to set some sort of safety agreements around the people who come here. So you couldn't actually let someone be here if they were maybe on drugs and alcohol, because then it wouldn't be safe for the other people. Well, of course, that was the end of the whole training, because they said, sorry, our charity's intention is to be, this center is for anyone, regardless of the space they're in. So I think it, to be trauma focused throws up some interesting questions. And I think people have to and they couldn't embrace that. And then later I found out their shelter is usually half empty, although it's the biggest in Sydney, because it's very, very scary and it's a dangerous place to be, because the druggies are there dealing drugs and the alcoholics are there, etc. So I think there's a whole, if you're going to be really trauma-informed, that means, first of all, creating a safe environment for the people. And it means, you know, setting a very clear safety agreements, and it means not having power over, and it means handing the power back. So there's a whole lot of things that I don't think people are doing from my experience. They're not actually doing. They talk about it. There's a whole lot of theory of trauma that's not actually realizing it's a peer support walk alongside model of, you know, I trained a women's refuge and it was wonderful because they did change, because they realized all the women were coming back again and again and again, because all they did was support them, help them, give them whatever they needed. What do you need? You need some food, you know. And then I said, but that's not what it's about. And it was really, they said, oh, we've just been rescuing them. And they kind of, now they have a different attitude of saying, what do you want? What do you want us to do? What can you do for yourself? And how can we help you to do that? What do you need to learn so it's not going to happen again? So, I think it's a very buzzword, trauma-informed practice, but I don't think it's in reality really being practiced in a lot of places, because it sends some big challenges for organisations.
No, I absolutely agree with you. I think it's a very trendy concept, the idea of being trauma-informed. But, you know, ultimately, as you say, that's about being safe. And if you can't get that basic priority right, then you're not being trauma-informed at all. And I think also, you know, the people do use those words interchangeably about trauma-focused and trauma-informed. And I would say a service such as ours, where you're trying to actually resolve trauma, is a trauma-focused service. But actually lots of services might not set out with that aim, but actually just to be trauma-informed would be a massive improvement. But that does mean prioritising safety. And I'm not sure that there's really a commitment to that. There's just a recognition that that's quite a trendy thing. That's where the literature is, the research is, but it's not enough really, unless you can follow with action.
And I think to learn about trauma, you actually have to learn it from survivors. I think there's a lot of academic teaching now, and I think only survivors can really explain what safety means. Yeah. I'll tell you how many times I talk about safety and people say, oh, I have a really safe office. It's really good. I always make sure the door's shut and da da da. And I say, how do you know the door should be shut? And they say, well, because that's safe. And I say, how do you know that's safe? I don't know what's safe. You know, there's a whole lot of assumptions around it as well.
There are, and there's a flip
assumptions side. They know what people say.
But there's a flip side to that as well, isn't there? And that's how you know whether you can recognise fear in yourself. And I think that's one of the questions we always ask people at interviews is, could you talk about feeling frightened with people when you experience that? And people will say, oh, I'm not scared. You know, somebody's just been shouting at them and bawling in their face and they've got a history of violence and they're saying, no, I'm not frightened. And you think, yeah, you are.
Stupid you.
Yes. You know, or a team of staff being kitted up in kind of like, you know, the helmets and shields and everything to take someone to segregation saying, we're not frightened. And it's like, well, if you're not frightened, why are you dressed like that? You know. Yeah. But again, that's another area that's not very easy to talk about in forensic services.
I think one of the biggest issues with therapists, etc., is the therapist's fear fear of emotions. Hmm? They don't want the client to be really emotional, because I might not be able to contain it. What happens if they explode? You know, I think people really have to, trauma-informed practice, trauma-informed whatever, is meaning that the person looks at their own stuff first. That's how I take it. We can only help people as much as we've helped ourselves.
Yeah.
You must hear and you must have heard very many painful stories about trauma and neglect. How do you manage to keep yourself so positive and resilient? How do you build that resilience in yourself?
Well, firstly, I'm always saying to people, happened today actually, it's not the story, it's the emotion. So I never hear details of stories, even if someone says, I need to tell you because I've never told anyone. I say, well, just tell me the feelings of what happened, you know, when you were locked outside and put in a dog's kennel or whatever. So for me, it's focusing on their feel. I think it's also because I had a terrible childhood myself, so I survived it. So there's not much really terrible stuff that's, and I don't mean this egotistically, I mean, I had to do some pretty terrible things in my childhood. Satanic ritual abuse is pretty heavy. So I think if you suffered it yourself, you don't get shocked by what's happened to other people as much. I think I have to own that. I think you go kind of, you know, I've survived. And it's really good because I can say to people, you know, when mothers are worried because their children have had to be, you know, the fathers had to be given access and they're being sexually abused and the mother's in a terrible space, I say, you know, look at me, look at other people. We survive. The human spirit is extraordinary what we survive. So don't know if I'm answering your question, David, but I certainly don't let people, the person today was trying to go into details of her ritual abuse. And I was saying, I don't need to hear the details because it gives a bad energy for you and it gives a bad energy for me. I just want to know how you felt when you went into this place and there were all these men and there was, you know, blood and blah, 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 blah. I don't want to hear the details because that's not healing for you. It's re-traumatizing you and it'll traumatize me and then I'm going to have to go and get rid of it. So it's not the story, it's the emotions. Mm. I don't listen to details. I did very early on listen to details too much. I don't ever listen to details now because I know it's not, the brain doesn't need for healing to tell somebody the details of what happened. I think it's re-traumatizing for the client to tell lurid details. You know, yeah, basically say there was blood.
Yeah, it's very well put. I do mainly agree. Yes, I think it's a kind of fairly tricky and difficult area, and I've certainly worked in places where stories of abuse were repeatedly told, and it was difficult to kind of really understand why it was. Sometimes they were told in a way that was slightly aggressive, you know, it was an attack upon the person they were telling the story to. So I think it's an enormously complicated area. But coming back to you, because you come across as being a very energetic and ebullient kind of person, and I suspect, and I don't know, I think you're going to tell me, that you do lots of very interesting things which fulfill your life.
Most of what I'm doing is working with people with trauma, if that's what you're meaning. My work is my life, is my passion.
Yes.
Because there's so much work done in this area. There is in every area. Today, there was someone talking to me about the awful thing about women, parents who adopt children and don't realize all children who are adopted have suffered from trauma and have to be healed from their trauma. And I thought, oh, that's a whole. So I started writing an article about that and saying, this is a whole area. That's so, so important. All these poor parents who adopt these kids from overseas, and because they adopt them at 6 weeks old, they don't know that the amygdala has formed and the kids already suffered trauma. You know, there's so much information we've got to get out there to the world. I think that's but I do rest when I stop. I do, like tonight, I do, if I rest, I stop.
Yes.
I go,
yeah. I've always loved my work. I've been very fortunate. You know, I've been able to do work, which is almost entirely working with other people. And I've always found it extremely rewarding. So it's always been a part of my life that has been self-fulfilling. You know, without spending my time rescuing people. I don't think I've taken that approach. But I suppose I would say I've always had something else. Like for the past 30 years, my interest in opera has taken a large part of my life, and I find it extremely rewarding and enriching, emotionally powerful.
Yes, I don't have any great hobbies, really, but I do completely. But, you know, the weekends, this weekend we'll go. We've got an apartment on the beach. Oh, we live in Australia. I mean, I'll lie on the beach on Saturday. I mean, I don't need any hobbies. Just lying in the beach in the sun and listening to the waves and watching all, children are always happy on the beach. And that will re-energize me and give me, you know, I used to ride my horse, but I can't anymore because my horse is lame. But that was always a great pleasure. I think some of us need lots of hobbies and some of us don't, but we all need to have something where we're not, we cut off from thinking about work, because I think that's really, really important. And I take a long holiday every year when I don't think about anything other than myself and my husband. And that's important.
Riding a horse sounds pretty good to me.
Oh, but where I live on a big property, it's great. I mean, yeah. I can walk for miles. It's England, you know, it's really hard in England to have the sort of place that we have here, you know, 340 acres of just, you know, native bush, basically. Well, so that's much easier than living in a city. And we know with COVID-19, how hard it's been for people to live in cities. It hasn't been a problem for us because isolation, living on a 340-acre property, is not exactly a problem.
And there remained that final question that we wanted to ask you, if you could think of a particular thing that's inspired you, be it a book or a film or a person.
Well, I mean, God inspires me.
Right.
I mean, when I feel really down, or I'm thinking, or if I'm with a client and I think, I don't know what to do now. It's great. Instead of, I just say, God, tell me what to do or do something, because I've kind of run out of options right now. I can't. And I just sit back and I say, I'm leaving it to you, God. And often I sit back and the person will suddenly say, I know what I need to do. And I go, inside, I think, thank you, God. So I think my inspiration is probably my faith, the fact that I know I'm supported. I know God's got my back.
Indeed.
And won't let me, you know, and will give me my energy and support. And it doesn't matter, you know, how black someone's, you know, how really evil and black someone is, that you know, that God created that person. So God created that person, so there is a beautiful golden soul inside every single person.
That's a really lovely way to end, I think.
Yeah.
A fantastic interview, Liz. Thank you so much for
so lovely to talk to you, Naomi. I so hope I'm going to get back to your program next year. Please invite me. I was so inspired by what you're doing, and so thinking it's so, you know, that's the sort of stuff that keeps me going, is when I go off and learn a new area and think, oh my, you know, it's just, isn't it?
Thank you. And
we come over here.
We will post your links to your program on our website as well, so that people can see how to access your program.
Yeah, that's always good, just because, and that's a great thing, isn't it? From what's happened, I'm now doing Zoom broadcasts and podcasts, things I never bothered to do before. So I feel like the world has become a smaller place. That's the real plus from it all. Really nice to meet you, David.
It's been a real
love
pleasure
to have more conversations
speaking with you.
Other than by a Zoom meeting, now I can go back to the last episode of The Crown. So you have actually saved me, because I can just watch the last episode and then go to bed.
Thanks so much.
Talk it on. No problems at all. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
So I'm just remembering what you said at the beginning of this, referring to your initial encounter with Liz, and I certainly agree with you. She certainly has a very powerful and energetic method that she's developed, and clearly people are committed to her process when they join up. I have to say, from my own point of view, anything which helps people to deal with their trauma is to be welcomed, and all kinds of varieties of therapy and encounter can be beneficial to some people, if not to all. And it's clear from what Liz was describing that many people have gained a lot from her group.
Yeah, I think I really enjoyed the conversation. I think it's really interesting the points that Liz made about kind of giving up on that survivor mentality, because I suppose so much of the programme is about engaging with people with lived experience because of the powerfulness of their knowledge and the lessons that they've learned being incorporated into a programme, and yet absolutely recognise the importance of giving up that survivor mentality. And it really made me think about the difficult journey that there often are for men, especially, I think, in prison, in that we actually have to work quite hard to get the men to recognise how traumatising their early lives have been. They tend to be presenting themselves as quite stoical and not wanting to admit to vulnerability. So I think we spend quite a lot of time working with them to help them recognise that actually what happened to them shouldn't have happened to them, and the realisation within them then that they are survivors, but equally totally see that the importance of then doing that work about helping them relinquish that survivor mentality so that people aren't clinging to it, because it can really hold them back.
Yeah, I agree. And there was something about what she was describing that reminded me of what I always think is the strength of therapeutic communities. The people who go to TCs have to face up to an awful lot of difficult experiences that they've had. And they can really only manage that because they're within the context of a highly supportive environment of peers and well-inclined groups of staff. And it sounded as if Liz's establishment is very similar to that. You know, they have a lot of play, they have a lot of parties, she described, and that must surely help them to contain, you know, the difficulty of the work that they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess as well, that sense of people gradually evolving and growing, and the importance of having people at different stages, does kind of give hope, doesn't it? I think it'd be very challenging to work in a service where you're working with people in isolation, or where people come in en masse together and don't have a sense of what they're aiming for in terms of how good their lives can be if they can get through the painfulness when they start that journey.
Next week, we're going to be meeting with Morgan Godwin, who's from Oregon on the west coast of the United States of America. She's another person with very powerful experiences here to tell us about.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to that. Should be a good listen.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.